So showing up in the organic results as well as kind of paid results. And so I was responsible for much other things of optimizing the home, Amazon homepage to show up in Google. And so I wrote I personally wrote the title tag of the Amazon homepage to get the right keywords in there. And nearly 20 years later, they haven't changed it. It's still the title I wrote.
This episode is sponsored by Sweep the Floor, a new podcast founded by ex-Amazonian Jason Verlinde. With Sweep the Floor, Jason interviews some of the most interesting and quirky makers working today, from woodworkers and mechanics to surfboard shapers to entrepreneurs. He just interviewed CEO and wooden canoe builder Trent Presler, the author of Little and Often, out now and purchasable on Amazon. Find the podcast at sweepthefloor.net. I'll link to it and the book Little and Often in the blog post. Hi, I'm Dave Chappelle, and I'd like to welcome you to the fifth episode of the Invent Like an Owner podcast, where I talk with the Amazonians who helped build Amazon.com into one of the world's most valuable companies. This weekly podcast is for entrepreneurs, business leaders, and all students of history. The goal of the podcast is to capture the Amazon creation stories and create a historical archive. On that note, my guests are recalling history as best they can. It's possible some of the details are fuzzy or just plain wrong. If that happens, it isn't intentional. I invite future guests or commenters on the site to help us get the facts as straight as they can be. Now, on with the show. Today, I'm excited to be talking with Blake Scholl. Compared to some of our previous guests, Blake arrived at Amazon a little later, in 2001. Still 20 years ago, but you'll see that there was still plenty of impact to be made. Blake conducted Amazon's first Google AdWords buy, and his team built the technology behind Amazon's large-scale automated search advertising on Google. Today, this technology drives billions of dollars in annual sales for Amazon, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a Google purchase intent search that doesn't have Amazon in the paid placements. Today, you'll learn about how Amazon worked to become the starting point for all shopping searches, and how that manifested in various investments and experiments by the company. And you'll also meet Blake, who's quickly becoming one of the most interesting people in the world, in my opinion. Welcome, Blake.
It's all very kind of you, Dave. Great to be here. This is a fun set of stories to share, and I'm excited to be talking about it.
Great. So you joined Amazon in 2001, fresh out of Carnegie Mellon, and it looked like several interesting internships at Real Networks and Inc. to me. What attracted you to Amazon versus other alternatives, or was it your own, was it your goal? You know, that sort of thing.
It did turn out to be my goal, but it wasn't my initial goal. I've always known exactly what I wanted to work on, although my view of what that is keeps changing. By the time I was sort of midway through college, I knew that ultimately I wanted to have a career as an entrepreneur, and I wanted to go somewhere where I'd be able to not just write software, but to really understand the business side and be able to contribute that way. And so I remember, like, you know, I was an Amazon customer since 97. And I went to the homepage at one point. I was like, oh, this is filled with stuff I love. And for like 20 seconds, I thought that some editor at Amazon like completely had all my taste in literature. And I thought that was awesome. Then I realized, oh, that's not that at all. There's software that's doing this. And I started to think, well, how do they do that? And so I fell in love with the kind of the automated merchandise and personalization technology. I decided that's what I wanted to work on after school. And I started, you know, researching who built that. And I interviewed with a company called Epiphany. And I was like, oh, do you guys do this stuff on Amazon? They're like, no. And eventually realized that Amazon was the place this was done in-house, and got to snag an interview. And so this was late 2000. And so the dot-com bubble was kind of imploding at that moment. And my friends would say, like, why are you going to go work for Amazon? It's a bookstore. And like, do they even exist anymore? But everyone I met there was like super smart. And, you know, down to the engineers who interviewed me, I could ask them business questions and they could explain like cash flow cycles and operating cycles. Everyone else says this is going under, but everyone I meet there really knows what they're doing. And so I went to Amazon to be a software engineer working on personalization software.
Was Matt Round leading the team at the time, or was it still Josh? Or
I think it was right about to transition from Josh to Matt at that point. I think Josh was leading it when I interviewed, and then Matt was doing it around the time I started.
Well, we're hoping to talk or interview both of them together in the next couple of weeks. So that's been top one to get just because it's such a good story.
Oh, that's going to be a great one. They're both fascinating people to talk to as well.
Yeah. So tell me about your first project then. So you were hired as a software engineer on the personalization team. Where did you spend your first, let's say, year or two? Was there one big meaty project that you started off with?
No, it was a lot of little stuff. The gist of that team at Amazon was it was very quantitative and very focused on incremental changes that would drive revenue or profit. And so your typical project, like 3 month project, was insanely long. Your typical thing was maybe, you know, three to 6 weeks of development effort. And then you'd get out there and you'd run a web lab, which was the Amazon term for an A-B test. And if it made money, you were happy. And if it didn't, you'd learn and, you know, iterate differently. And so I worked on a bunch of different things. A lot of it was either related to people who bought this item also bought, or performance of the website and performance of the personalization features. Like, I remember at one point I was charged with making the homepage faster, which is in some respects a hard thing to do. We redid some of the data architecture that helped. And then what we realized at one point was that we render the entire homepage of the website to a buffer. And then when we were done, we'd send the whole thing. And so I ran a little A-B test that would just basically dump the buffer after, if you think back to then, there was like the tab bar. And so we're like, well, what if we flush the buffer after the tab bar? And it turned out that like drove another like percent or two of sales, just to have the tab bar appear faster. And so lots of little things like that.
So when you worked on the homepage, let's just call it a speed test, was that more for shopping because it loaded faster, people bought more? Or did it also relate to sort of an early premonition that page speed would be something that Google and other search traffic senders would like?
Well, Amazon, I think, had an early recognition that speed mattered, which I guess that ends up being a theme through my career in some ways. They had an early idea that speed mattered. I think at the time there was like a goal to have the homepage under 6 seconds, which of course sounds a little bananas 20 years later that, you know, you'd allow the homepage of Amazon to take 6 seconds to load. And so there was, you know, when we went and measured, because you know, Amazon would measure everything. When you do one of these A-B tests, you get back a report that's like 200 variables long with statistical data on everything that would happen. And so we sped up the homepage by just sending the tab bar faster. We saw two major effects. One was that people were less likely to just leave the site. Because you know, there's a bit of an effect of like you type in Amazon and if it's just sitting there and kind of not doing anything, you're much more likely to say, I guess it's not working, I'll go somewhere else. And then it also changed where traffic went on the website. And one of the reasons it drove increased sales is people would stare at that tab bar longer and they'd be more likely to go into the personalization features. So back then there was a whole tab that was called like your store. You know, it'd be like Dave's store, Blake's store. And that was where all the algorithms would like try their best to sell you stuff you really want. And it was one of the best pages for generating sales on the site. And so getting the tab bar out there turned out would drive more traffic into the personalization features, which drove more sales.
Yeah, it's funny. You would almost think you want to load the search box, then load the tab bar or vice versa, and then sort of top to bottom load the page if it were possible.
You would think, but this was 2001 or 2002, and Amazon search was not very good back then. So search was not the best place to drive people. And a lot of sales you'd get through quote unquote discovery, or people were not necessarily coming looking for one thing, but they're kind of browsing. And the personalization features were really good at getting people to buy things that they didn't know they wanted through browsing experiences.
Was Amazon beating that 6 second time before you got involved, or how long did it take in your memory like to get there?
Oh man, my memory is very fuzzy on this. My recollection was that this was a multi-team effort that went on for months before it really succeeded. And then once it got to 6 seconds, the new number was 2 seconds, and then even more effort to get there. But the big culprit on the homepage at that point was personalization, because it was remember the data architecture of the early 2000s. There was an Oracle database and a service that would give you the most recent items that a customer had bought. And then there was a whole set of data that would effectively, today people talk about it coming out of machine learning, but it was like baby machine learning that actually fed the personalization algorithms. And that was a gigabyte or two of data that lived on literally every web server. So there were, you know, maybe a few hundred web servers at Amazon. Every single one of them had a copy of this data. And this is back when chips were 32 bits. So they all had 4 gigabytes of memory. In fact, there was more data on these machines than would fit in RAM. And so you're going out to the hard disk a bunch. And so computing personalized recommendations was something that was very computationally intensive. And so the work that we did to kind of shrink that data set and then ultimately put it in a service-oriented architecture made a big difference to the speed of the personalization features, which in turn made a big difference to the performance of the homepage of the website.
Right. And something that people might wonder about is for a person who visits the site who's never been there before, was the site faster for them because there was less quote-unquote personalization going on, or did they have new problems?
In fact, personalization was this like is backwards from how you wanted it to, because the more you bought at Amazon, the worse it got. In fact, from a couple different aspects, back then, the average customer had bought 2.5 items. You know, and today, I don't know, people buy 2.5 items a day from Amazon. And so what would happen was that the more stuff you'd bought, the more input there was in the personalization algorithm, the slower it would get, which is that the last thing, you know, so the best customers had the worst experience, which is very pessimal. In fact, I remember, I'll tell a funny story. So Amazon had this trouble ticketing system, and there was this notion of a severity one or severity two incident, which is like something is massively wrong in the business. Like, you know, a sev two is like a big part of the website's broken. A sev one is like the whole website is broken, or there's something wrong in the warehouse and you can't ship any packages. And there was this page you could go internally to see all of them. And I was very curious. And so I would just like load these for entertainment because I was just curious what was going on. And at one point there's a SEV2 ticket that says customer 857-3592 can't load the homepage. And you're like, well, why in the world would it be a SEV2 ticket if one customer can't load the homepage? And so of course you click on it, and I probably shouldn't say who it was. It was not an Amazon employee, but it was well-known external individual who had been the first person in Amazon history to buy 1,500 items.
I know who this is, by the way, because they were mentioned in a question in the last episode that we had to delete because they were buying things for their library, I believe. So anyway.
That's believable. So I won't cause you that same editing chore by mentioning the name. But yeah, so this individual bought more than 1,500 items, which broke the wire transfer protocol from one of the personalization services, and the homepage wouldn't load.
Awesome. So you spend a year or two working on lots of things, the homepage project. We're going to talk a lot about the automated advertising work you did. How did your role evolve to start working on that? Was it something you signed, like you were excited about doing? And maybe give some background for listeners about like early internet gatekeepers and this problem that you were tasked with working on over a couple of years.
Yeah, well, I guess I can tell a little bit of my personal story, and then I can also tell the strategic story, which probably could be a little more interesting. So my personal story is before I went to Amazon, I had sort of accepted the job, but I didn't know the first thing about any kind of automated merchandising or automated machine learning kinds of stuff. But I was terrified I would suck at it. And so the summer before I actually started, I decided like, okay, I wanted to go build some stuff on the side that would get my feet wet with it. And so being a 20-year-old, what did I think of building? I thought of building a dating site that would match people up with algorithms, you know, like people who looked at this profile also looked at. And so I went and built that for fun. And, you know, and then I was like, well, how do I get people to the site? And that was right around when Google had launched AdWords. So this was summer of 2001. Early summer of 2001. And so I figured, okay, well, you know, this looks like a cool way to get people to the site. And so I just started playing with AdWords, and I got to kind of know the system through having promoted this dating site I was building. And then, you know, and then so fast forward a couple of years, now it's, I think, late 02. And my manager walks into my office at one point, and he's like, hey, there's this project called like, see if we can make any money buying ads on Google, that keeps getting like kicked from team to team, and somebody gave it to the biz dev guys and they couldn't figure out how to do it. And so, you know, do you think our team should work on it? And if so, you know, who should work on it? And I was like, how about yes and me? And so it kind of landed in my lap. And so it was teed up as like, okay, like this is all just an experiment. And like I said earlier, this is coming from the context of project is rarely more than like 6 weeks, you know, maybe a little bit more than that in this group. And so we thought we didn't have a lot of time to go kind of figure out if there was even a there. And moreover, Matt Round, who you mentioned earlier, who would be awesome to have in the show, you know, called me into his office. He was my manager's manager at that point.
Matt, essentially for listeners, was, I think, director or VP of personalization. So he ran the personalization.
Yeah, he was director of personalization. Yeah.
There you go.
He was one of the many people who had followed Bezos from D.E. Shaw to Amazon. And so Matt's like, Jeff cares about your project, and if you mess up, he will micromanage your project. And so you need to go meet with Jeff and basically earn his confidence very early on, so he'll leave you alone to get it done.
Well, the flip side of it is you could say, well, actually, I want a lot of time with Jeff, so I'll mess up just enough, you know, to get exposure.
Turns out I did that without even trying. So,
yeah.
So I go and have I'm like 20, 21, 22 at this point, and have my first meeting with Jeff, and it's on a Friday at 5 o'clock. And so I'm called into Jeff's corner conference room, and I'm like, you know, it's me and my direct manager and Jeff, and I'm just like nervous AF. And Jeff walks in, and this was back when Amazon, with the Segway had just launched, and Amazon was the distributor for Segway. And Jeff's icebreaker was, hey, want to ride my Segway? And so we spent 15 minutes going up and down the halls of the office riding Jeff Bezos' Segway before we sat down and actually had a conversation. And he was very, very specific about his strategic guidance. And he didn't want us to teach anything to Google while buying ads. And he told me a story about something that had happened in the fulfillment centers. And so, you know, as I think people know, the early Amazon fulfillment centers were all insourced. And then there, as they were scaling, people start to build e-commerce warehouses. And so Amazon would outsource some fulfillment. And what happened is all the fulfillment outsourcing companies, like, they all suck. They weren't as good at it as Amazon was. And so what did Amazon do? They would like teach them how to be better because they want their suppliers to succeed. And then what do their suppliers do? They go offer like now higher quality fulfillment services to all of Amazon's competitors. And so Jeff said, you treat Google as a mountain. You can climb the mountain, but you can't move it. I'm pretty sure that was very close to word for word what he said. And so, okay, well, we'll have to figure out how to buy ads from Google at scale without really talking to Google. At the time, I didn't appreciate why in the world is this project I'm working on as like a 22-year-old, kind of on the side from my team, something that the CEO is interested in. At the time, I think I thought, oh, Jeff thinks it's cool. But looking back, I think there was like a massive strategic reason why this got so much attention. And as this whole thing played out, like I'd see Jeff, sometimes it was like, you know, 6 weeks apart, and I'd have to update all of the leadership team, the S team, at least once a quarter on how this whole thing was going. So why? Well, this was the early 2000s. It was not clear yet how shopping would start on the internet. And you know, Google was on the rise, and it was a big strategic question, is shopping search different from web search? And if it turns out that shopping search is not different from web search, then you could expect that people would go to the Google search box for everything they might want. And then anybody who wants to sell anything on the internet is basically gonna have to pay rent to Google for the privilege.
And prior to Google, just for people that are young and don't remember AOL, like prior to Google, there was the AOL, the Yahoo, and these places basically charged us rent. Like we had to buy mega deals where we would sponsor the book category and the music category and the video category. In the early days, that was how Amazon got a lot of traffic. But as Google and iOS, let's say, and Android, but as Google became dominant, they became the big gatekeeper, whether paid or organic. And so you're basically talking about the top of those Google results were mostly paid.
You're right. Like there's basically, where do people start on the internet? In those days, it was mostly not Amazon. So Amazon would have to pay, you know, call it 5 to 10% of sales to the gatekeeper for the privilege of having gotten the traffic to the site. And so if there's a new place, say Google, where a lot of traffic is going to start, you need to get really good at showing up in it, or better yet, you need to have a strategy such that people will start e-commerce search at Amazon, which would be a massive strategic advantage. And so when I look back at it, you know, I think Amazon had a plan. This is no authority higher than me looking back 20 years later and thinking about what must have been going on. So this is not gospel. And it might be if you talk to more senior people, they'd say, no, Blake's crazy. This is a completely different story. But my view of it is Amazon had plan A. And plan A was to become the equivalent of the default app for shopping. And when people wanted to shop, they wouldn't type Google or anything else. They'd type Amazon.com and they'd start there. And as a result, if you started at Amazon, then you're buying from Amazon is kind of innocent until proven guilty. Only if you can't find it there do you ever go somewhere else. And it's a massively advantaged position to be in if you can get people to think of Amazon anytime you want to buy. Again, this was early 2000s. People still thought Amazon was a bookstore. And it was, you know, that was a very ambitious target. So that was plan A. And I think they had two plans B. Plan B1 was what I was working on, which is get really good. And, you know, if you lose at coming the starting point for shopping search, you got to be really good at showing up where shopping search happens. So plan B1 was be really good at buying ads on Google, be more efficient at that than anybody else. So you've got a competitive advantage there. And then plan B2 was to go compete with Google. And Amazon, people, I don't remember this now, but had its own search engine called A9, tried to go head-to-head with Google, and that didn't go very far. It turns out that's really hard. So we made a run at plan B1, the stuff I was working at. But ultimately, Amazon made plan A happen. And I think the key strategy for plan A was Prime. Because once you got somebody in a Prime membership, you know, they'd always want to use it. And so they'd want to start at Amazon to see what could they get with free 2-day shipping before they'd ever go anywhere else.
And yeah, 27 episodes that talk about how plan A ended up happening. But you're right. Like an episode interviewing Greg Greeley about Prime is probably very high on the list. And I already spoke with Dwayne Bowman and Ruben Ortega a little bit about A9. So there'll be an episode on that at some point down the road as well. And so B1, what you worked on for paid, I'm assuming there was like a B3 as well, which is getting good at organic search. I don't know if that's something you ever tackled or just something that your personalization teams worked on later as well.
Yeah, my team ultimately owned both. So I was considering both of those as variations on B1. So B1 is show up well at Google. And of course, the best way to show up in Google is to be the top of the kind of organic or free results and not have to pay for traffic. And then if you don't succeed at that, then you have, you know, then paying for placement is potentially a good idea. In fact, we did a lot of work trying to figure out if you were high on the natural search results, did it make sense to also buy an ad? You know, and to what extent was traffic cannibalized? And that was a very difficult thing to study. Google did not want us to study it for obvious reasons. And yet we tried to do some work on it.
Okay. And so you gave the background on where you think the idea came from and your interest. Let's talk about how did you go about building it? You know, when you said, all right, I'm taking over the Amazon paid placements on Google. Did you approach it as a 6-week project or did you guys know from the beginning that this was going to be a many-month or multi-year project to get right?
Well, I remember lobbying Matt Round, and he gave me two software engineers, myself included, for 3 months, and which was like in that context, like an incredibly generous gift of resources to be able to do anything. And so the idea was, let's run this for 3 months. Let's see what we can do in 3 months, and then we'll look at the numbers and see whether it's worth doing anything else. And so, okay, a couple things strategically were clear from day one. One was the way everyone else was buying ads on Google at that point was completely manual. You know, you'd go to Google's little web UI, you'd type in the keywords you want to show up for, and you'd write your ad and hit submit and, you know, bid on the ads. You couldn't do it at Amazon scale without automation. And the other thing that kind of relates to that is web search is incredibly long tail and incredibly heavy tail. The numbers from the time were, I think, 300 million unique searches per month. And of course, Amazon had, I think, either single-digit millions or low double-digit millions products in the catalog at that point. And so everyone who was doing ads – sorry, I missed one piece of context here that's important. Google sold the ads in an auction. And this was like one of their brilliant innovations is you'd pick a keyword, you'd write your ad, and then you'd bid how much you're willing to pay for click. And they would look at what your bid is, and they look at what your click-through rate on your ad is. And you multiply those two together, you effectively get what you're paying per time they show your ad, per impression. And so they would rank the ads by payment per impression. So you could get your ads to show up higher, either by making ones that people are more likely to click on or just being willing to pay more for the clicks. And so you had to know, you know, so it was competitive to show up high. Because everyone else was doing this manually, they could only go after the most popular keywords. And so if you looked at the across those 300 million searches, the vast majority of them had zero ads. You know, but if you search on something really popular like books, you know, of course, there's a whole stack of ads. And so for our sort of MVP, for our version one, we said, we're going to ignore the popular stuff. And we're going to only look at the unpopular stuff. And, you know, we will buy scads and scads of keywords that are searched on infrequently. And in fact, we don't even have to decide what to bid in the auction. We're going to either bid the minimum bid or we're going to turn the ad off. And so it would bid either 5 cents or zero. There's the only things that knew how to do in version one. And it would pick like large amounts of obscure keywords.
Did you get the search terms just by looking at our logs of what people were searching for on Amazon? It's so long ago that Google was still passing search information to sites because they stopped doing that, right?
Turns out both of those are far better ideas than what we actually did in version one. What we did in version one was we'd like sift through the whole catalog and we'd look at like the titles of items and authors of whatnot and try to use those as keywords. And I don't know why we just didn't think of using the search logs. It's a far better idea. And once we had that idea, it worked way better. We launched without that. One of the things that was key to the way we architected the whole thing was we knew there'd be a lot of different strategies for how you could decide how to make ads. And if you were going through the catalog, you'd have potentially know this is the name of a book, for example, and you know exactly what book it is. And you'd be able to put like the price of the book in the ad. And so we had these things that were like kind of Mad Libs, but they were like different Mad Libs depending on how you came up with the ad. So there was one that was trying to, you know, basically single product ads. And there was another one that would look at, you know, we know about series of books like the Harry Potter series. You know, if you know it's a series, you can write the copy of the ad so it's like a little bit better. And then eventually you had the idea that you were just talking about, like, oh, we could go through the search logs. And that was like another source of keywords, another way to build Mad Libs. And the whole system that we built basically had an internal API that you could like load ads into. And then it had this system that would basically track what people would buy or not buy after clicking on the ads, figure out whether it was a good ad. And if it was, it would bid it up. And if it wasn't, it'd just turn it off. And so one of the things that was nice about that is if you woke up in the morning, you had a new idea for how to pick keywords and write ads, you could code it up, load in a bunch of the ads, and the system would, you know, separate the wheat from the chaff just by tracking what was working well and what wasn't.
So two questions. You weren't writing the ads, were you? I mean, you didn't have an editor. Were the ads being written, you know, via programmatic form sentence writing? And then were you factoring in things like what was the contribution margin of a product so that you would know what the maximum amount it would be? I understand you started at the 5 cent level, so you didn't have to worry about it there. But like, you know, did you factor in availability? Hey, this thing's out of stock, so we don't, even though it's a great ad, we don't want to be running it. Like, how complicated was it?
Basically, all the things you just mentioned, at least by the time it was kind of version 1.5. So if it were the single product ads, yeah, it would look at availability and it wouldn't buy ads for things that were, you know, not in stock. And the way it would kind of figure out was an ad worth buying or not is it would track every click and it would track what people bought after every click. And we had contribution margin data on a per product basis. This is something that was actually very, very difficult for Amazon to create and make high quality. But at least we thought we knew how much money we made from any given product sale. And so it would add up all those contribution profits and that would tell you what a click was worth. And then it would bid kind of a percentage of that click, knowing that it would make some money on the spread and kind of guaranteed not to lose money. So that's the way it would work kind of in mature categories. And for categories that were new at the time, like apparel was new, jewelry was new. And at that point, it made sense to be in investment mode and to spend a higher percentage of sales. So on a product line by product line basis, you could tell it, do you want to make money or do you want to drive sales? And if you want to drive sales, what percentage of revenue are you willing to spend on ads? And it had those two modes. Now, you were talking about the ad writing and it was basically Mad Libs. So you could have these little templates and then you'd fill in the templates with whatever, you know, the title of the book or the name of the series or whatever the search keyword was. And we didn't have any editors. And I wrote a lot of the templates myself. This is very Amazon, you know, oh, what are the resources for that? Well, you're the resources for that. And just get it done. Don't ask anybody. Just go make it happen. And I'll tell a little funny story on this. I ultimately owned SEM and SEO. So showing up in the organic results as well as kind of the paid results. And so I was responsible for, amongst other things, of optimizing the Amazon homepage to show up in Google. I personally wrote the title tag of the Amazon homepage to get the right keywords in there. And nearly 20 years later, they haven't changed it. It's still the title I wrote. And it reads funny because it's like Amazon.com, online shopping for apparel, computer software, DVDs. You know, it's like Amazon still advertises on their homepage that they sell DVDs.
You'd have to be pretty bold nowadays to go in there and change that, though. You're like, is this really a good idea, you know, for some 23-year-old to – that is weird.
Yeah, because the last 23-year-old left it in there, you know, 2 decades ago.
And it seems to have worked. To get all the data from Amazon, was there an Amazon web service? Were you leveraging the Amazon web service for the e-commerce data, or were you going in getting it directly from databases without that API?
E-commerce web services – approximately didn't exist at that time. They were just getting created. And so there were other kind of pre-web services APIs that we mostly used. And I think over time we switched to the web services APIs. A lot of that might have actually been after my time.
One other question, because you mentioned that you really weren't talking to Google, but how did you place the ads if Google didn't have an API to work with at the time? I'm assuming they do now, but...
They do now. They didn't then. So this is a great question. Well, we built a screen scraper. And so... At the time, I think you were allowed to have only 2,500 keywords per Google advertising account. And so we built this little screen scraper that was basically a virtual web browser. And it would go to AdWords and it would open an AdWords account. It would put in Amazon's credit card to pay for the ads. And then it would like put in 2,500 keywords. And then when it ran out of space for more keywords, it would open another account and put more keywords in. And we did that without calling anybody at Google. And eventually they called us and they're like, what are you doing?
Like, we're sending you money. You should be happy. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. That was a whole adventure. I remember at one point I woke up in the morning and the system would send emails, email reports of, you know, how much money it was making and whether anything had gone wrong. I get up in the morning, the email reports say that it can't download any data from Google and nothing's working. And so at this point, we did kind of have a sales contact. And I called them up and said, what's going on? And they said, well, your system overnight took down AdWords. So we had to lock you out. You know, okay, well, how did it do that? Well, it woke up at 3 a.m. and it requested like dozens of expensive to compute reports in parallel, and that was enough to crash AdWords. Eventually down the road a little bit, they said, look, why don't we build you an API? And so they did.
One other thing, you mentioned it was you, and who was the other engineer that was working on that with you?
In the very early days, it was Joanna Power, and then Quincy Hunt built the front end for some of the reporting tools. So it was really 2.5 engineers. Quincy only counts as a half because she wasn't on it full time.
Did it work? Like, did it work out of the gate? Was it a massive overnight success? Like, because in my mind, this thing was a runaway success out of the gate, but maybe that's not the case.
Not out of the gate. And so I talked earlier about this notion of the strategy where we targeted the tail. The large number of keywords that each one would not show up very often, but would target very narrowly to specific products. And so in version one, we kind of overshot on that strategy. And so we picked like a bunch of obscure keywords, including like this thing was making up keywords that no one ever searched on. But when it hit like spectacularly. So that this thing would pay 5 cents and it'd sell a book for $20, or it'd sell a digital, it'd have the individual model numbers of digital cameras. And so if you search on a given model number and Amazon had that one featured, of course, Amazon had good prices, like with very high probability, you'd click on that ad and you'd buy the camera. And so it was extraordinarily profitable because we're getting sales for 5 cents. That said, it was so far out in the tail, it wasn't getting very many. And I was so young and naive at the time, I didn't realize that I was supposed to build something big. And I was very focused on this idea of like, you know, what margins can I achieve with these like really cheap 5 cent clicks? And I remember running into Jason Kilar in the parking lot on the way in one day. And Jason was...
For the listener, Jason Kilar was, I think, a senior vice president in charge of media pretty much. And now he runs like a digital version of HBO, but...
At the time, he was senior vice president of like worldwide consumer software. I think he had run the media business before that, but he moved over. He's running all of the software at this point. And yeah, I think he runs Warner Media now, like all of it. He ran Hulu for a while. So Jason's been phenomenally successful. And so Jason's like, well, how much stuff have you sold? And I like say with pride, I think we sold 400 units since we launched. And he's like, what? That's it? Like, why are you selling millions of units? And I'm like, but we only spent like $10. to sell those 400 units, but he wasn't very happy about the ratio. He was like, why is this not larger? And so I got called into his office along with Jeff Holden, who was the VP over our area, and got told that I didn't have a plan to make this work and I really better come up with a plan. And so at that point, I realized I still didn't know why I was in the hot seat, but I knew I was on the hot seat to make this thing scale up. And so we went through this crunch period where we launched two new features that turned out being the couple things that made it really big. And feature number one was like, Dave, you had the idea, like the very first thing you thought of it, which is just using Amazon search logs to come up with search terms and then just linking those ads to the search results. And, you know, for not very good reasons, we'd resisted using that idea earlier. But it turns out it's a great source of keywords. And the search results, especially with the work that Ruben and Dwayne had done with optimizing the first few search results, the first few were really good. And it turned out, you know, people didn't mind. You know, we thought people would mind clicking from one page of search results to like another page of search results, but it turned out not to be true. It worked really well.
If it's a good page, which has what they want, you know, it's a minor speed bump.
Right. It's like it's one more click, right? You know, yeah. Digital Rebel Model 3, whatever, click on that. And now you're on Amazon, click on the same thing. It's not the end of the world. You know, you're on the product detail page pretty quickly. We built that. And then we built we called it the variable auto bidder, which was this module that was smart enough to bid numbers other than 0 and 5 cents. So it had some way of figuring what percentage of the gross profit do I want to bid in order to maximize net profit. And we launched those two things, I think it was like July or August of 2003. And then the thing took off like a rocket ship.
By that time, did Google take you off the credit card? Like, you know what I mean? Were we still paying? Because had the relationship gotten closer with Google along the way just because of volumes and API development and everything else, or was it still very...
At that point, we were still on the corporate credit card. I remember Amazon launched the apparel store. Mm-hmm. I think it was 03. And the search advertising was considered like a big part of the promotion and launch strategy for the apparel store. And so we were kind of on the hot seat with that. And the corporate credit card hit its credit limit over the weekend. And so what did I do? I put up my personal credit card. So for a little while, all of Amazon's Google advertising was on my personal card, and I got a monster expense report.
You must have like 9 million credit card miles.
I got a lot of cash back, but it was actually hard to get the reimbursement. So I remember thinking, oh, probably my manager can't approve this. I'll like put it into the director. Your director has approved this, but he doesn't have enough authority. So it's gone to your VP. And it's like, oh, your VP has approved it, but he doesn't have enough authority. So it goes to your SVP. And then it ended up at the CFO's desk. And ultimately, the only way I could pay that credit card bill that month was to go knock on Tom Skutak's door and say, pretty please, would you approve my expense report?
That's funny. Tom Skutak was the CFO at the time at Amazon. So it took off like a rocket ship. Do you remember the numbers? Was a rocket ship $1 million a month, a week, a day in ad spend? Or like,
I actually have still a chart that shows the sales ramp.
Oh, please email that to me so we can put it in the blog post. So that would be great if you can send that over.
This was the chart my team gave me when I moved on. The system is called Urubamba, which is a river that is a tributary to the Amazon, which is how we got the name. And so those lines there are OPS, which stands for order product sales. So it's basically sales, you know, plotted over time. So you could tell early on, we weren't selling very much. And then you see these spikes. What were the spikes? That was the holiday shopping season. Once we kind of figured out a couple of the key things, then it had some massive growth in sales. So that green line there is the cumulative. So it ramped pretty nicely.
That's awesome. If you can shoot a picture of it and send it to me, I'd love to put it in the post itself. That's great. And so, side question, was this one of the first two pizza teams, or was that even established at that time? Because I kind of remember it as such, but I don't know if that's the way it was thought of.
Yeah, I think it was one of the first two pizza teams. And so the audience doesn't know, the concept of two pizza team was a team that's no larger than can be fed by two pizzas. So it's 8 or 10 people tops. I guess it depends on the size of the pizzas and size of the people. But the idea was you would work on a separable mission and you would have something called a fitness function, which is some quantitative way of measuring, are you succeeding at what you're doing? And so this thing, you know, naturally led itself to very simple fitness functions. It basically became a P&L. You know, how much gross profit are you bringing in and how much you spend on ads, and subtract those two numbers, and that's roughly how well you're doing. You know, with some adjustments in there for things like, you know, new stores that we wanted to promote where we were willing to be unprofitable.
Were there any other big mistakes made along the way? I don't know if it's obviously a massive, monstrous, big win for the company. Were there any other sort of funny mistakes along the way, like rampant bad bidding or unprofitable bidding that took a couple days to find?
We could probably fill up several podcasts with the mistakes we made, but I'll tell a couple stories, the most cringeworthy moments for me. One was, so we were doing this not just on Google, but also on Yahoo, because it turned out, you know, back then Yahoo had enough market share that you wanted to work with both of them. And Google was very highly automated in basically every piece of how this whole thing worked. And Yahoo was not. So when you submit an ad to Google, it would go through like an automated editorial check, like, hey, are you buying swear words? You know, does it look like it's porn? You know, and if it did, it would be flagged for an editor. But there'd be kind of this automated approval most of your ads would get out. Well, Yahoo would have a human look at every single one. And here we are at Amazon. We're just like throwing millions and millions of ads at Yahoo. And I think Yahoo had more people working on manually reviewing our ads than we had people working on the whole team that built the system that created the ads by like a factor of 2 or 3. Like, we were creating a massive employment at Yahoo with this system. And so eventually they cried uncle and they're like, well, we trust Amazon. You know, so we'll just turn off all the editorial checks and we'll just like, you know, auto approve all of your ads. You know, it was very nice that they were so trusting, but it was actually a very poor decision on their part because we didn't have any automated editorial checks on our side. And this thing would buy ads for everything. And so there was a period of time where we were the only advertiser on Yahoo for the keyword porn. They weren't supposed to have ads on porn, but because we got around the editorial checks, we could buy the keyword porn. And I mentioned earlier that one of the strategies for coming up with these Mad Lib ads was to look for book titles. So there's a book called 688 Ways to Make Love Like a Porn Star or something like that. Or no, I think it was actually How to Make Love Like a Porn Star. That was the title by Jenna Jameson. And so the headline says How to Make Love Like a Porn Star. You know, and below that it says, you know, free super saver shipping on, you know, orders over $25. But the headline says How to Make Love Like a Porn Star. So if you go to Yahoo and you're someone who's searching on porn and you see How to Make Love Like a Porn Star, well, like, you click on it. But it turns out a book is not at all what you're looking for in that context. And at the time, the part of the system that was automatically looking to see who had clicked on what and what was selling and what wasn't and turning off the loser ads was broken. And so, and it was down for some ungodly amount of time, like 5 or 6 days. And the timing was just horrific enough that the system bought this ad on Yahoo for porn and didn't discover 5 days that it sold not – it generated like hundreds of thousands of clicks and sold literally zero items. Literally zero. And so I remember having to go to my boss's office at that point and explain why it is that we had bought a bunch of completely worthless ads for porn. So that was one.
Well, I'm assuming that probably led to some type of automation to check very unprofitable ads or something like that, like ads where there was spending with no purchases and that sort of thing.
Oh, well, we had that automation, but it was behind and broken. So that the whole you might imagine that there was like some very clear way you could tell who had clicked through the site and what they had purchased. But it turns out we didn't have that system. And the only way we could get through it was going through the web logs from all of the website. And so this was an enormous amount of data. And you had to process it serially because you had to see when someone clicked through from Google, what the tracking ID was on that. And you had to follow that user all the way through and see what they purchased. And so it was a lot of data. It was compute intensive. We didn't have like any kind of good infrastructure for distributed compute. So this is all running on a small number of compute boxes, kind of single threaded. And if something broke, it would get behind, and then it was like really difficult to get it to catch up. And you could see it in the profitability of the system. Like longer you went without kind of closing the loop on what was selling and what wasn't, like the worse the financial performance of the whole thing was. And so it turned out like the biggest way to make this thing work better was just like speed up that process, just like get better at knowing what people had bought after a click and then turning it back around into a decision to buy the ad or not. But when it broke, it was really painful. Which reminds me of another story. I think it was holiday 04 or 05. When you go through the holiday season, the profitability of everything ramps. And so people's propensity to buy, you know, if you look at like sales per click during the holiday shopping season, it's much higher than it is the rest of the year. And so you want to bid up your ads and pay more. And then as soon as you hit the kind of holiday shipping cutoff and people aren't going to buy as much anymore, you want to like rapidly turn the bids back down. And so if you don't build the software for that, you'll have the effect where basically you underpay during the holiday shopping season and then you overpay after the holiday shopping season. And so we built some what we thought was very clever software that would rapidly figure out kind of how was the site-wide conversion going and use that to adjust the scores of individual ads. And we thought we were all very clever. But it turns out after there's a confluence of two bugs. One bug caused us not to turn on new ads when we wanted to. And the other bug caused us not to turn off ads we wanted to turn off. And so, yes, this is a bad combination of bugs. So after the peak of the shopping season, where this thing was like in the black and it was making loads of money, all of a sudden it's massively unprofitable. And you know, for a couple of days, we're like, I guess the algorithms are taking longer to catch up than we thought they would. But then it keeps losing money. And we're like, what is going on? And eventually we figured out that these two bugs existed that caused us basically to only run bad ads. Literally the opposite of the set of ads that you want to run is what you're actually running. I remember getting hauled in front of the VPs for that one. And I think it was Jeff Holt who said to me, this thing was a rocket car. Then the wheels came off. And I was like, well, Jeff, doesn't that just make it a rocket? And he's like, you're missing the point, Blake. And I remember my performance review that year had a picture of a rocket car in it. Not necessarily in a great way.
Yeah. Well, look, I wanted to talk actually about organic search, but we might have to try to beg some time for a future episode because we're already at 50 minutes. I wanted to ask a little bit about learnings from this, like sort of if you step back from it and say, you know, for future entrepreneurs, what types of things do you think that they should learn from this? And then I do want to spend a couple minutes talking about your post-Amazon experience because it's really unique, as you know. So when you think about learnings or the types of leadership principles that most resonated with you and in this project, what type of things do you think entrepreneurs should be thinking about or people, innovators inside companies? I mean, you were an innovator inside Amazon that ended up having a multi-billion dollar impact.
I mean, I was very lucky to have that. And I was very lucky to have that so early in my career. So I'll throw out a few random lessons. One is if you can find things at the intersection, if you're at a big company and you can find things at the intersection of stuff you think is really cool that you'd love to work on and the company thinks is really valuable, you're going to get some insane acceleration in your career. I totally lucked into that, but I thought the Google Ads thing was cool. And for reasons I had no clue about at the time, you know, this is something that I'd have to update the CEO on like every 3 months. And so when I was screwing up, I had some really, really smart people telling me I was screwing up and like riding my butt to get it fixed quickly. And so it was this like accelerated aging process where I got to learn way faster than I would have in other contexts. I think that's one lesson. The other thing that made this fun, interesting, quick learning is it was very measurable. Like, you know, you could tell in end of every day, whether you'd made or lost money, you know, buying these ads and at what volume. And so you could tell quickly what was working, what wasn't working. And that led to this process where you could iterate and improve it very clearly. And so it's a very, very short gratification cycle. Not everything is like that. I look through my career, I've learned to live with like longer and longer gratification cycles on what I'm doing. But this is fun because it was very short gratification.
Yeah. I mean, literally some people would work 6 months on a project or 3 months on a project and launch it, it might fail. Whereas you were able to, once you got it live every single day, even the 400 units sold, the 400 very highly profitable units sold, at least it was, you knew. And once it did get the visibility, you were able to ramp it up very quickly and continue to see. So,
yeah, I mean, we're saying very quickly, but the reality was it took the better part of a year to figure that out.
Yeah.
And there was a period of time where Amazon wasn't sure we should stick with the in-house technology, and they were competing us against some third parties that they thought were smarter. So it was, and which was very, very painful. And it was a learning for me not how not to react to that defensively and politically, but how to wear the company hat and not the team hat.
Yeah. So just make sure we get out of here on time and respect your time. It's a Sunday night that we're recording this. So tell me about your post-Amazon experience. And really, I want to talk most about Boom, but you know, maybe just give the short version.
Yeah.
And
I left Amazon in 06, and I was part of a couple different startups. One was founded by Jeff Holden, who I mentioned earlier. It was kind of one of the very first mobile apps companies pre-iPhone. And after that, I started a mobile e-commerce company called Kima that was acquired by Groupon. But what I learned, almost in a way, kind of bridging back to the stuff we were just talking about, is you really want to work on stuff you're passionate about. And the stuff I did at my own company, even though we managed to sell it to Groupon, like I wasn't that excited about. And there is nothing like working on internet coupons to make you yearn to work on something that you really love that's going to matter to the world. And then I made a left turn in my career that it is very much a non sequitur from my resume to found Boom Supersonic, which is building high-speed passenger airplanes. And so my backstory on that was...
Wait a second. Repeat that again for everybody. You were a personalization engineer and had a couple startups, and then you're now building supersonic planes?
Yes, it sounds a little surreal when you put it that way. But no, we want to build... You know, I think I had a throwaway line earlier that a lot of things in my career are about to making things faster. And so I'm working on making air travel faster now. And we've built and rolled out the first independently developed supersonic jet ever. It's going to be flying in not that many months and will ultimately allow tens of millions of people per year to travel in half the time it takes today over long distances.
I'm literally, I've got goosebumps. Like I didn't actually know it was so close. I've obviously followed along. And so did the idea come from early interest in the Concorde, or was it more of a speed thing? Like, where did you just take that one? Maybe that one side story is, it's a, such a massive vision. Where did that seed get planted?
Well, I've loved airplanes since I was a kid. My parents will tell you that I've like loved airplanes since I was 6 months old. I've been flying for fun since I was in college. And in my mid-20s, when I was in that, at that startup called Pelago that Jeff Holden had founded, I remember at one point I was waiting for my girlfriend, who was one of these like horrifically delayed flights. And I'm just sitting there waiting for her, thinking like how much better life would be if she'd arrived at like Mach 2 instead of on the airplanes that existed today. And I started researching it. And I put a Google alert on supersonic jet because I wanted to be first to know when I could go buy a ticket and break the sound barrier. And for the better part of a decade, it was just crickets. There was like no credible effort to pick up where Concorde had left off and to build something mainstream. And I could see, you know, from day one, for me, this was like a very, very human thing. My kids had a grandfather who lived in Hong Kong. Sadly, he passed recently, and the kids got to see him maybe five or six times in their lives, period, because the time to Hong Kong is so long. And when I contrast that with my own upbringing, I'd been an hour and a half away from my grandfather as a kid, and I learned so many things from him. Like, there's no way I'd be an entrepreneur if it weren't for the relationship I have with my grandfather. And so I look at this, and I'm like, why do my kids not know their grandpa? It's because the airplanes that we have today are no faster than the ones we had when my parents were growing up. And so I was very motivated, having spent time at Amazon and in tech. You know, I grew up in a world where everything is getting faster and better. Why aren't airplanes getting faster and better? And so I knew I wanted another startup, and I wanted to work on one where I would never get up in the morning and think, why am I doing this? Is it worth the pain? And as entrepreneurs, if you're driven, which every entrepreneur is, you work at your personal red line. And working at your personal red line kind of feels the same no matter what you're doing. You can't go any further than that. And you're up against the most you can possibly do. And if it ever gets easier, you just find a way to do more. What's not the same between every startup is how motivated you are And you know, how worth it is it to kind of run at your red line and go through all those difficult patches that you're invariably going to have? And so I thought I would sort all my startup ideas by how happy I would be if it worked. And I figured I would, you know, cross off the first X number ideas as impossible or bad. But as luck has it, I'm still working on number one. And I got, you know, I got kind of 2 weeks into the research on it and discovered that most of the conventional wisdom about why supersonic wasn't happening was wrong or obsolete. And it didn't stand up to, you know, very simple quantitative analysis that you could do with basically no background, with spreadsheets you could build out of data in Wikipedia. That was 2014. I spent about a year kind of just learning aerospace, reading textbooks, took an airplane design class, networking, hired my first people in 2015. And today, Voom is nearly 200 people. We've rolled out the XB1 demonstrator airplane, which is, like I said, it's in ground test now. And within the next year, it's going to be flying. And then our Overture passenger airliner, which will take you across oceans in half the time that takes today's airplanes, is going to be in the air in 5 years.
It's incredible. Was this at all inspired by what Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are doing with rockets?
Oh, yeah. Like, there's no way I would have had the courage to do it.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in my basement in 2014 thinking about startup ideas and thinking, well, like, Elon went from PayPal to SpaceX, and rockets are probably harder than airplanes. So if he could do that, well, you know, at least this is theoretically possible. You know, I don't know if I said I could do it, too. It was a, you know, I had to sort of decide not to care what I thought I could do. And say, like, the only way to know what you can do is just to try. And so forget about the weather, put all your attention on how. And if you fail at it because it was impossible or you weren't up to it, well, at least you know you tried. You never have to be like 80 years old on your deathbed thinking, like, I wonder what would happen if I tried to build supersonic jets.
Yeah.
So you can't, when you've got that mindset, you can't lose. Either it works or you tried.
It's back to that quote we've all heard many times about Jeff when he was leaving D.E. Shaw and he said, and he left in the middle of the year and didn't get his bonus. And he's like, I know for certain when I'm 85 and dying that I'm not going to regret having missed out on that bonus. You know what I mean? But I'll probably regret if I don't take a chance on this internet thing. And it's very resonant. So
honestly, I might not have made that decision if it weren't for that very specific story from Jeff, which has really influenced how I make some of the most important decisions in my life.
I love it. Well, look, thank you so much for being a guest. I do hope you consider coming back and doing the SEO version of this with you and or, you know, somebody else from that team, because I think that's another really fascinating story, because that work is probably also driving billions of dollars in sales. So just the automated advertising story would have been great, but you also shared many other great stories. And even the final mention, the Boom inspiration is great for other entrepreneurs and innovators to hear. And it's just great to see you. I haven't seen you. We've spoken, but I haven't seen you in a long time. For the audience, thank you for listening to the Invent Like an Owner podcast. If you'd like more details about what we discussed today or want to send me edits and improvements, please visit inventlikeanowner.com to sign up for my newsletter. I'll also put up any photos from Blake for that chart and or photos or videos you have for Boom planes. I'd love to include them in the post. So yeah, Blake, thanks again.
Thanks, Dave. This is a real blast. Thanks for taking me down memory lane and getting to tell some fun stories.
Awesome. So that's it for today. And remember, no sniveling.